I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:22 p.m. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Freer on Teams, Fields, and Hall. We have three bills on the agenda today. HB 362, Respiratory Care License by Labor and Commerce Committee Bill. HB 260 by Representative Josephson, and HB 350, Qualified Entity Income Tax. First up is HB 362. We heard this bill for the first time last week and set an amendment deadline for 10 a.m. this morning. We did not receive any amendments. Jen Wilkerson, do you want to come to the table to give us a recap on the bill?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. For the record, my name is Joan Wilkerson. I'm the committee aide for Co-Chair Hall. And on behalf of this committee, we've presented HB 362. I can't summarize it better than we've done in the sponsor's statement. As a quick recap, this bill would establish licensing for respiratory care practitioners. We would be the 50th state to do so. By licensing them with every other U.S. state, by implementing licensure for respiratory care practitioners in Alaska, be a crucial step towards protecting patients and ensuring professional accountability. It's defined a clear scope of practice in line with national standards and establish a biannual renewal and requiring continuing education to keep clinical skills up to date. It would grandfather existing certified respiratory therapists working in the state, recognizing their service while maintaining a high standard of care, and requiring registered respiratory therapist credential for new licensees, aligning with national standards and current healthcare needs.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wilkerson. Does anyone have questions for Ms. Wilkerson, Representative Hall, or Angela Euler, who we heard from last time, the Director of Respiratory Care at the Sleep Lab and Cardiac Pulmonary Rehabilitation Center from Central Peninsula Hospital? And we are going to do public testimony as well, and members can ask questions of testifiers if they wish. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Ms. Euler, actually, if you can hear me, Ms. Euler, in looking at this bill, I was trying to ascertain, what is the problem to be resolved, and I understand the benefits that a professional licensing board can bring to the public and to the profession, but I'm just curious, are there any really smoking guns where somebody has been found to be practicing as a respiratory therapist or respiratory services practitioner who is not qualified and was therefore putting the public at risk? Any egregious violations that this legislation would remedy?
Yes, we actually have had. Oh, sorry, just one moment.
Sure.
Is that better? Sorry about that.
Oh, all good. It sounds great now. Thank you.
Okay. We actually have had that happen in the state. I do know that at our facility in particular, we did have an issue with an individual who came and somehow passed a background check for the state of Alaska but had lost their license elsewhere. They should not have been practicing in our state. We promptly were able to let that person go, but had those safeguards been in place, it would have kept that from happening.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Not seeing further questions. Ms. Euler, thank you for being available again. At this time, we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 362. Is anyone in the room to offer public testimony? Looks like no, therefore I'm going to go online. First up in public testimony is Lindsay Gilday, who I believe is the state delegate for the Alaska Society for Respiratory Care Board. Please proceed, Ms. Gilday.
Hey, yes, for the record, my name is Lindsay Gilday. I'm also a registered respiratory therapist, and I work as the outpatient service manager in Solana, Alaska, at Central Peninsula Hospital, as well as the state representative for Alaska Society for Respiratory Care. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of the House Bill 362. Currently, Alaska is the only state in the nation without licensure for respiratory therapists, and that does include Puerto Rico and Guam. Licensure is an important safeguard. It protects both the professionals providing that complex cardiopulmonary care and, most importantly, the patients who rely on that care. In healthcare, we often say, treat every patient as if they were your family member. I know that if one of my family members needed respiratory care, I would want that person taking care of them being licensed and held to the same professional standards as every other state and the same standards as every other healthcare professional providing critical care here in the state of Alaska. I've worked as a respiratory therapist for 16 years. 8 of those years have been here in Alaska. And before moving here, I worked at many hospitals across the state due to military PCS assignments, and every facility I've ever worked in, part of the mission has always been improving patient safety. However, without licensure in the state of Alaska, we do lack that key layer of accountability that exists in every other state. Licensure helps ensure that those providing respiratory care meet professional standards and have not lost the privilege to practice elsewhere, as Ms. Euler stated out. Without that safeguard, we leave our healthcare system more vulnerable and risk allowing individuals who may not meet those standards to practice in our state of Alaska. 3 times a year, all state representatives meet with the American Association for Respiratory Care. We discuss ways to strengthen and advance our profession, and at every meeting, Alaska is called out for not having licensure. And I would be so proud to attend our next meeting and share that Alaska has finally joined every other state in recognizing and licensing respiratory therapists for the safety of patients and the advancement of respiratory care in our state. So I respectfully ask for your support of House Bill 362, and I thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gilday. Next up in public testimony is Holly Pulaski, the treasurer of the Respiratory Alaska Society of Respiratory Care. Thanks, Ms. Pulaski, for being here.
Thank you for having me. Hello, for the record, my name is Holly Pulaski, and I have been a practicing respiratory therapist in Alaska since 2017. Over the years, I've worked for both Providence and Alaska Native Medical Center. I work with all patient populations, from neonates to adults, in the emergency room, inpatient floors, and intensive care units. As such, I've had the pleasure of working alongside some really great RTs and some that probably should not have been allowed the ability to practice in our state. For these reasons, I also believe we need licensure to help hold us accountable for our professional practices and to help maintain a level of patient safety that other states uphold. Respiratory therapists in Alaska often make critical decisions at the bedside in real time, whether it be managing ventilators, titrating oxygen, and responding to emergencies across various patient populations. With that level of autonomy should also come clear accountability. Licensure provides that accountability. It establishes a consistent professional standard for who is qualified to practice, ensures our competency, and creates oversight to protect patient safety. When we are trusted to make life-saving decisions at the bedside, there should also be clear and enforceable standards that ensure every respiratory therapist practicing in Alaska meets the same level of training, professionalism, and responsibility. For the safety of our patients and the integrity of our profession, I encourage you to support respiratory care licensure in Alaska. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Pulaski. Next up in public testimony is Carl Hinkson, who's the past president for the American Association for Respiratory Care. Mr. Hinkson, go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for allowing me to testify on this. I am testifying on behalf of the American Association for Respiratory Care. I am a respiratory therapist and a director of respiratory therapy for Providence Swedish in Washington State. The AARC represents approximately 120,000 respiratory therapists who practice nationally. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 262, Respiratory Care Licensure. Licensure is an important tool for state governments to protect patients. This does so by ensuring educational standards are met, competency standards are met, but most importantly, it protects patients by having a formal oversight system to prevent individuals from migrating from state to state to facility to circumvent core things elsewhere. It also helps define the scope of practice, which protects patients by ensuring only qualified people provide certain amounts of care. And it also protects the therapist by defining what is in their scope of practice in case they're asked to do something that they are not trained or competent in. So again, I strongly support this. Bill 262, Alaska is the only state in the union that has not recognized respiratory therapists through a formal licensure. And I will take any questions you may have.
Thanks, Mr. Hinkson. Not seeing any at this time. Next up in public testimony is David Arthen. Mr. Arthen, please proceed.
Hi, I'm David Arthen, and I have been a registered respiratory therapist since 1983. I worked at Alaska Native Medical Center 26 years, with the last 2.5 years as lead therapist. I then moved to be the respiratory therapy supervisor at J-Bear Hospital as a VA employee. I managed the respiratory therapy department, sleep lab employees for the VA, and home oxygen program. I worked all facets of respiratory therapy in that time. My wife and I organized and pretty much ran the annual Alaska State Conference for many years. We feel the importance of respiratory licensure for the state of Alaska is paramount for patient safety, standard of care, and considering the fact that we work with the very most severe ill patients, that this is of utmost importance to assure that we have therapists who are responsible and accountable for their actions, taking care of all neonates on up to those adults that are severely ill. I support HB 362 and hope you will as well. And as a last note, we are always in on every single code blue episode in the emergency room, intensive care, and we would not want any unqualified respiratory therapists or therapists who are not highly skilled in this realm. Thank you. And I'm available for questions if need be, please.
Thank you, Mr. Arthen. That is the final testifier. Do members have any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Sadler?
Thank you. To any of the folks, through the chair, any of the folks who testified, we have been told a couple of times that Alaska is the only state without respiratory therapist licensure. Is there any general experience you can relate as to how it's worked in other states, if there's any hiccups on initial adoption of the licensure? Trying to look ahead to any possible potholes down the road, short term. And that's to anybody.
Anyone can jump in, any of the testifiers.
To my knowledge, I have not been aware of any hiccups that have come through. It seems to be pretty, the flow seems to go fairly well any time that's been adopted. However, I've not been directly involved with starting this up in any other state. I'm currently licensed in Montana and have been for many, many years. And anything that has come through has been handled pretty smoothly from everything I can tell. I don't know if anybody else on the call has been involved with that directly, but that has been my experience.
Thank you, Ms. Wheeler.
Okay. Well, thank you to all the testifiers. With that, I'm going to close public testimony. Is there any further discussion on the bill before we take action on it? Representative Klum.
Is the department here to talk about the fiscal note?
Yes.
I would like that.
Thanks, Ms. Robb.
Hi. So, through the chair, Ms. Robb, in the back or the second page, it kind of explains things. So, but I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. So, it's $46,000. As for the first year, and then subsequent years is $41,000. Looks like it's DGF. So I guess just clarification for the part that you explained is the DGF. I assume is license fees for the respiratory. Like what DGF is it, and why is it start at 46 and go to 41?
Yeah, thank you for the question. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, through the Charter Representative Cologne. Thank you for the question. You are correct. The source for the funding is receipt-supported services, and that will come from the licensing fees charged to the respiratory therapists. The difference, the decline in costs from the first year to subsequent years is related to the fact that we will need to do a regulations project if this bill passes, to adopt the regulations related to this, and so that comes with a certain amount of costs for postage and mailing to alert people to the regulations, as well as paying for Department of Law's time to review that regulations project.
And follow-up? So the National Association training, there's travel, 4,000. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, through the Chair to Representative Cologne. So the travel, so this would be a program, one of, this would be the 25th professional licensing program that's overseen by the division. We send people to the national conferences to ensure that we are staying up to date on national trends and that we are, you know, keeping those regulations current, that we're on the lookout for anything that we need to be aware of that's changing within the profession, since we don't actually employ any respiratory therapists.
Follow-up?
Yes.
So it's pretty standard for any profession you license. You go to the events. It looks like it's probably more than an annual event.
Through the Charter Representative Cologne, that is correct. So for almost all of our professions, for the professions with boards, typically a board member and a staff person will attend those national conferences for division-regulated programs. We do try to attend because as the regulatory agency, it's incumbent upon us to ensure that we stay up to date with what's happening in the field.
Yeah. And one more?
Yes.
If I may. So the personal services is $17,000 for the cost of reclassification for a full-time license examiner. So you have a position, but you have to reclassify it. Is the $17,000 a salary difference, or why is it $17,000 to reclassify a position?
Through the Charter Representative Cologne, that is correct. So the current position that we would be reclassifying is an office assistant 2. Those positions are range 10. We would reclassify it to a licensing examiner 1. Those positions are range 14. Okay. The difference in personal services between those two positions is the $17,600 that you see.
Okay, and one last follow-up. Do you have any sense of how much the fee would be for a license? Like how much would the respiratory therapists have to pay additionally to fund the department?
Through the Chair to Representative Cologne, obviously not a profession that we've regulated, but looking at professions, so while we've heard a great deal of testimony that there are 7 individuals who are in the state now who are practicing in Alaska. I believe there's 1 additional individual who's lives in Alaska but doesn't practice here. From talking to folks, they're projecting I think around 130 or 150 individuals would be required to be licensed. So once we have licensure, if you are treating an Alaskan or someone in Alaska, you must be licensed in Alaska. So that's the difference between how many people we have now and that future number.
Oh, okay.
Looking at our non-boarded programs that have approximately that many of licensees, we have 4 that have between about 130 individuals and 180. License fees for those programs range from $100 to $325 for 2 years.
For 2 years.
Yeah. So, and it does depend. We keep very close tabs on the actual cost spent on the program, and so their actual license fee will be based on the cost for this program. But based on those other programs, that's certainly we're seeing.
That's a good
Within that range.
Okay. Thank you so much for all the clarification.
Further questions?
I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Absolutely. She's right here.
Oh, I didn't know if staff was coming up or, I mean, I don't think it's a hard question. I was just wondering, so I was reading through the other day, reading through the letters of support, and there is an asthma letter of support, but there's like, I don't know, 30 letters, and they're all from out of state. Why do out of state therapists care whether we license in Alaska or not?
Through the co-chair, thank you, Representative Colon, for the question. I believe the answer is because it is in everybody's best interest for Alaska to become the 50th state that has a licensure, because it's in the best interest of public health.
Mm-hmm. Just a general, they just want all the states to have licensure.
Correct, yes, because it's in the best interest of the profession. Oh, and I'm happy to turn it over to Ms. Euler, too, if she has additional perspective.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Euler.
Yes, absolutely. Patient safety just remains the bottom line for all of the states, and they're very supportive of us. Some of the other states are aware that there are therapists that tend to make their way up to Alaska, and patient safety is their main concern. So that is a big part of the reason why all of the other states are so supportive of us having licensure as well. Patients are what keep us going, and that is their concern.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
All right. Co-Chair Hall, do you have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 362 Work Order 34-LS1128/N out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. Seeing no objection, House Bill 362 is reported from committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign paperwork and for Representative Josephson to come up to discuss HB 260 next. At ease. On the record, next up is House Bill 260. Thank you, Representative Josephson and Mr. Albert, for being here. We do have some amendments. Do members have any questions for Representative Josephson or his staff or the department before we go to public testimony and amendments? Okay. Not seeing any questions, I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony? I don't see anyone. Is there anyone online who wishes to offer public testimony? I don't see anyone. Therefore, I'm going to close public testimony and go to amendments. So we have, I believe, five amendments. And the first two are from me. And then Representative Sadler has a few. So I will start by offering Amendment 1 or N.1.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
Amendment 1 is pretty simple. It deletes the word employee on page 1. Line 13, this is essentially recommended by the bill sponsor in the previous hearing. Representative Josephson, would you like to speak to this amendment and your view on it?
Thank you, Andy Josephson, House District 13 in Anchorage. We view this as a friendly amendment. The chair is right. We recommended it. We honestly don't know entirely why this was put into law in the first instance, so we do not oppose it.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. I offered a similar amendment later on the grounds that if the purpose of the bill in general was to devolve the responsibility upward to the contractor or primarily owner, then holding the employee at the lower level to the same level of consequence was not quite in keeping with the theory. So obviously, I had an amendment. I thought it was a good one, so no objection.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Hall?
I remove my objection.
With the is there further objection? Seeing no objection, Amendment 1 passes. I will now move Amendment Number 2 or N.2.
Object.
This amendment requires that subcontractors provide records to authorized representatives of an employee if certain criteria are met. And Representative Josephson, would you like to speak to this amendment?
Andy Josephson, for the record, I also think that this is an important amendment consistent with the idea behind the bill, which is that the subcontractor should cooperate as to record keeping so that the contractor can comply with his or her ultimate responsibility to make sure wages are paid.
Yeah, and this is just to provide further explanation. We just want to make sure that someone cannot withhold documentation and therefore prevent the law being carried out. A pretty simple intent. Are there questions about this amendment? Representative Sadler.
Yes, sir. And Mr. Chairman. So through the chair, may provide information, AS section, to an authorized representative of an employee. I'm not sure who might be situated. Who is an authorized representative employee? Not a lot of contractor subcommittee subcontractor workers who might be swinging a hammer, you know, laying tile, is going to have their own agent. So who's Northrop's representative of an employee, please?
You didn't know this was the movie industry.
I didn't know. I've got to
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, some of this language was derived from an Oregon statute. We noted that, and I think in the first hearing, I agree with you that these must be very sophisticated people to have authorized representatives.
Yeah.
I don't know if Mr. Alper wanted to add anything to
that. Go ahead, Mr. Alper.
Thank you. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Representative Josephson, and to Representative Sadler's question. I think what we have going on here is there's a wage claim happening. The subcontractor is providing information to a contractor about that they've paid everyone. They would have an attorney, someone who might be helping them in their wage claim. That's who I imagine the authorized representative might be.
And Representative Sadler, just to add a little bit to that, that could also include a wage and hour employee with the department, because under Alaska law, if there is wage underpayment, either an attorney or a representative of the Alaska Department of Wage and Hour could represent that employee for seeking that information. So I could, as this amendment reads, I would certainly think that a wage and hour division employee would qualify as an authorized representative of the employee.
And I'd follow up then.
Yeah.
So the sections, let's see, there's a fair amount of information, name, address, telephone number, so forth, all this information in Section A, the affidavit, the anticipated start. Is there any provision for that to be confidential at all if it's provided to someone who is not the employee but an authorized representative in the case you describe an employee of the state government?
Representative Sadler, I think this is actually a fairly standard process when the department, say, checks certified payroll for a Davis-Bacon project.
Is there anyone from the industry we could ask that question of? Because, again, this is an area I don't have subject matter expertise. Is there anybody from a contractor who can speak to this? Or?
Well, we
or
don't.
Or authorized representative of a contractor.
Right. Tell you what, we don't have anyone online right now. Why don't I follow up with the Department of Labor and see who else. I mean, we can take action on this, but also answer your question about the processes for protecting private information, because it is very standard that contractors document certified payroll and provide it when needed to the department. So there are pretty well-established processes there to protect privacy.
Sure. That information might be helpful as I decide how to vote on this particular amendment. Is it possible to rustle them up during the pendency of our meeting today? Because if we vote to pass it, then I find out something, then it's kind of not real good.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Go ahead.
When I look at line 20 of page 4, 20 and 21, I think it offers Representative Sadler some of the protections that he's seeking, in that the records would have to be otherwise lawfully required to be disclosed. So now one could say, yes, but did the authors of AS 2310.430 get it right in terms of confidentiality, et cetera? But assuming they did, it just strikes me that that this is just in sort of linked to that disclosure requirement.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Through the chair to the sponsor, and respectfully, is subparagraph B necessary if the law already provides for this kind of disclosure? This kind of stuck in my craw a little bit when I was looking at the bill earlier. Is this really necessary? And it may be an artifact from the Oregon bill. Or
Yeah, well, and I have an opinion about that too, Representative Sadler, while Representative Joseph thinks about it. I think if we're going to pass this bill, it probably is better to be clear. Go ahead, Representative Joseph, then Mr. Alper, whoever wishes to answer that.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, I'll take a crack. Representative Josephson is right that the B and the change, with or whether shall or may, is only viable if and only if sub 2 is in play. Sub 2 is if the employee themselves is eligible to get the information, the employee's representative would therefore be eligible to get the information. I think that's and for some reason, if someone wanted to withhold that information from the representative, the shall makes that stronger than the may is all. Sure.
And, go ahead.
And I find that persuasive. I read that the same way, digging through it, so thank you. So I did not object to the amendment, but my question has been answered.
Okay,
so now I have a question.
Of course.
Okay, so when I was reading this as a subcontractor, you're basically telling the subcontractor you have to give the employees personal information to the general contract or the ownership of the project, whoever's going to have to pay the wages. Is that correct?
Well, I guess it's my amendment, so I'll try and answer, and then Representative Joseph or Mr. Alper can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't really read it that way. I would read it that if a subcontractor had been a subcontractor would have provided, say, wage information related to, say, compliance with prevailing wage law, which is, I think, consistent with existing law. But that's different than, like, personal identifying information, if that makes sense. It has to do with compliance with labor law.
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying, so in this case, though, you don't just put a position. You'd have to have a name because that guy was the one right. that didn't get paid. So there is personal information.
Yes.
In this case.
And there are existing state processes to track compliance for prevailing wages, which is the obvious example that springs to mind for me. So I think you need a name associated with it to make sure that they're receiving the money that they earned, mm-hmm. Which is different from, you know, other personal identifying information.
So, but this is between two private entities. This isn't going to the government, right?
Right.
You're making one private entity give another entity personal information. I don't know if that employee allowed that or not or what that process looks like, but I think the maid and the shell is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Okay.
May I?
Go ahead, Mr. Alper.
Mr. Chairman, so the intent of the bill broadly is to prevent or make it harder to have wage theft, to make sure people are getting paid. And subpart A, which is not part of this amendment, says that a contractor can require their subcontractors to provide them with certain information so that the contractor could be maybe a better watchdog of making sure that their subcontractors are good actors and not underpaying their people. No. When that happens, when data is going from the subcontractor to the primary contractor, the employee themselves has the right to get that information is what sub B is getting. Hey, if you're giving the stuff to the general contractor, let me know what you're giving them. So you may provide the records to the employee or to the employee's representative if it's specific to yourself. If I'm the employee, I can't expect the whole data set, just the part that pertains to me personally. So the amendment here is really just how definitive is it? Is it a may or is it a shall? But it's all information about the employee themselves going to the employee and the employee's representative.
So it's not going to through the chair. So it's not going to the subcontractor. It's going to the employee.
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb, it's the subcontractor's own data about their own employee.
Yeah.
Part A, the subcontractor is providing it up to the general contractor. Part B is they're also then providing it to the employee themselves.
Okay, so it's Part A that I have a problem with, not Part B.
Through the chair, that might be the case, but
okay.
That's not this amendment.
Okay.
Yeah. And Representative Sadler has a question as well.
No, actually that was the same same interpretation I have. Sub B is definitely a subsection of A, and I do have on some of the same grounds some concerns about subparagraph A, but that's not the immediate subject of our amendment unless we expand it with a conceptual amendment.
Okay. Is there further? Well, I guess I should say, does Representative Hall maintain her objection to Amendment 2?
I remove my objection.
Is there further objection to Amendment 2? Okay, not seeing any. Amendment 2 does pass. Next up is Amendment 3, or N.3, I believe, from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got to wait. The Chairman, I move Amendment N.3.
Sorry. Object. Sorry about that.
There we go. I understand the eagerness. Very good. Mr. Chair, and I guess to the sponsors, well, right now the bill kind of imposes a two strikes and you're out, you know, for failure to have a certificate of fitness. It just seems to be kind of harsh. To lose 90 days of a session with a suspension is pretty much the entire part of a construction season. That's going to cut a lot of money out of a contractor's season. But then on the second violation of a permanent revocation, it's a death sentence. That's the end of their livelihood. And I dug through the statutes. I did not see a provision for reissuance ever of a certificate. It could be a lifetime ban, which just seems like, you know, two strikes, you're out. And looking through the statutes on bonding, the three strikes, so to speak, three strikes violations before revocation, that's a standard that is established elsewhere in statute, particularly AS 08-18-121D. If a contractor fails to meet the requirements of being bonded, they get three suspensions before their contractor registration may be revoked. And actually, it's may, and that's at the discretion of the commissioner. So to have this be a harsh, you know, two strikes, you're out, I just think is a little too much. If the purpose is to educate and nudge people towards better behavior, then I think you're probably going to do better with a little more graduated imposition of the penalty. So I guess I'm being the merciful.
And go ahead, Representative Joseph, then. Thank you for sharing your perspective on this amendment.
To the chair, we have no opposition to this amendment.
Okay.
Andy Josephson, for the record, no opposition to amendment N.3.
All right. Is there further discussion on this amendment? Do you maintain your objection, Representative?
I remove my objection.
Okay. Is there further objection? Seeing none, Amendment 3 passes. I believe, Representative Sadler, you won't be offering N.4.
That's identical to one which we already adopted.
And Representative Sadler, would you like to move Amendment 5?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment N.5.
Object.
This, for the committees, this amendment eliminates the requirement that a sub must provide specific information to the project owner, most specifically including an affidavit that in the last 5 years, I'm going to paraphrase, that they have been involved in any wage theft, violation, or enforcement, or paid any penalties. Again, this seems excessive. It feels like it puts a subcontractor in what amounts to double jeopardy. Presumably, even if a subcontractor in the last 5 years had been involved in such a situation, if they had not complied, paid their debt to society, paid any fines, endured whatever suspension, then they are fully legally capable of doing something. They should not be held to an extra standard. I guess in my cute, I'm going to say there should be no scarlet letter W for wage theft.
Go ahead, Representative Jessica.
Andy Josephson, for the record, to the chair, through the chair to Representative Sadler. I do not support this amendment. The concern is that fundamentally this is part of the other four prongs where the contractor is trying to determine who to hire as a subcontractor, and I think should be allowed to know. And by the way, these records may not be, particularly after this bill, if this bill becomes law, one couldn't easily go to the court system and the court view, rather, and find these sorts of records. So given that this is a self-policing sort of bill, right? I mean, part of the reason for the bill is there just isn't enough oversight by the Department of Labor. This is another tool in the toolbox for a contractor or project owner to know who they're contracting with. And so for that reason, we think that it's well-written and appropriate. And, hopefully given the previous amendment that was adopted, there shouldn't be – we've just eased that penalty phase to some degree. So we think that it's proper and balanced to keep sub 5 on page 4.
Okay. Is there further? Oh, go ahead, Representative Sadler.
I appreciate the perspective through the chair to the sponsor. There is the effect of reputation. If a subcontractor is a bad actor, construction industry being somewhat insular, people know people and the reputation gets around, that is to some degree an enforcement mechanism. Secondly is, in this committee, we often hear about licensing requirements and that you can have a reciprocal license if there is no current active enforcement activity. And I think if this were to be softened to any current enforcement activity going on to someone's certificate, that might be appropriate. But a five-year look back still feels to me like double jeopardy. If you've paid your debt, if there was a violation, it's probably been adjudicated and the fine paid and the penalty endured. And that should be sufficient. I mean, it just sounds like we're asking too much. It's like, can you prove to me that you haven't had a speeding ticket today? Or give me an affidavit. And frankly, getting an affidavit takes time and money. And just to me, it feels just a little bit onerous.
All right. Maybe that's a closing argument for the amendment if there's not further discussion. Representative Hall, it sounds like you've maintained your objection.
I maintain my objection.
Okay, will the secretary call the roll?
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Co-Chair Fields.
No.
Co-Chair Hall.
No.
Representative Freer.
No.
Oh, she's there. 3A, 4-nay.
Okay, so by a vote of 3-4, Amendment 5 is not adopted. I believe that takes us to the end of amendments. And thank you, Representative Josephson and Mr. Alper, for being here. We'll return to this bill shortly. And the final item on the agenda is a first hearing for House Bill 350, Qualified Entity Income Tax.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we're not going to vote on this one? We're going to hold up till later, or just curious?
I think maybe we'll return to this one later this week.
Okay.
Full time for reflection. So HB 350, will Evan Anderson please summarize this bill, and then I'll just make a brief comment on it. Thank you. Briefities. All right, back on the record, last item on the agenda, and we're going to be out of here by 4:30, is House Bill 350, Qualified Entity Income Tax. Evan Anderson, would you mind summarizing this bill?
Sure. Thanks, Co-Chair Fields, Co-Chair Hall, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. This is Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. I'll be giving a short presentation for House Bill 350. This is an act establishing an income tax on certain entities in the state. You will see this term throughout the bill, qualified entity. To answer the question, what is a qualified entity? They are businesses that are exempt from federal income taxes. That includes sole proprietorships, partnerships, LLCs, and S corporations. This bill, however, sets a pretty narrow target on those pass-through entities that have greater than $25 million in taxable income in a calendar year. And it sets an income tax rate exactly equal to the existing corporate income tax of 9.4% for income above that threshold. A brief history of how we got here. In 1958, Congress created the S corporation tax classification, and at that time, that was meant to support small businesses by allowing income to pass through the entity and to be taxed only at the shareholder level. So what that means is, as shareholders receive disbursements, they pay federal income tax on that. But getting to this next point, since Alaska repealed its individual income tax in 1980, this has created a gap where C corporations pay the state corporate income tax, while very large non-C corporation businesses with comparable profits do not. So there's no tax there's no state revenue at any end of the system when it comes to these pass-through entities. I will not be going through all of the text on these next two slides, but I did briefly want to offer a comparison. I don't think it's a great comparison to compare Alaska to states with the personal income tax. So this, instead, on the next two slides, is just a comparison of Alaska with every other state without a personal income tax and how they treat S-corps versus C-corps. The conclusion is that Alaska and Florida are the only two states in the country without a personal income tax that do not tax S-corps. So you'll see on here Tennessee, Texas, Wyoming, South Dakota, all these states either have corporate income taxes that they apply to S-corps, or they do not have a corporate income tax that does not apply to C-corps or S-corps. So that makes, again, Florida and Alaska the only two states without a personal income tax that do not tax S-corps. So this bill, very briefly, closes that loophole for S-corps and other pass-through entities that are otherwise exempt from federal income tax. The bill also directs the Department of Revenue to aggregate income across related entities. And by including unitary business income, they can determine whether an entity exceeds the $25 million threshold, ensuring that large business groups cannot avoid the tax by splitting income across multiple affiliates. So this is a targeted reform that could improve the fairness and sustainability of Alaska's revenue structure without requiring a broad-based tax increase on households or small businesses. And that concludes the short presentation.
Thanks, and I guess I would just say I introduced this bill because I don't think it makes sense for a state to have a highly inequitable tax structure for large corporations that encourages what economists call rent-seeking activities, i.e. manipulating the way in which you're incorporated to take advantage of a tax structure. I also don't like that the debate around S-Corp has sort of become a debate about Hillcorp. I think Hillcorp does a great job developing gas and Cook Inlet and oil on the North Slope. That's a good thing. And if we want to close the S-Corp loophole, my preference would be that we not target oil and gas companies and certainly not target one company, but just step back and say, hey, we should have a degree of equity in the way that we tax large corporations. So that is the impetus for the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Representative Carrick.
Thank you to the sponsor for bringing this forward. Are there other, without listing them perhaps, but are there other entities that are in this bracket that would be affected by currently anyways?
Sure. The odd thing about bills like this is because these entities are not currently taxed, the Department of Revenue is not able to tell us how many and which those might be.
And just as a follow-up comment, it makes sense to me to structure this bill this way because ideally we would have businesses of this size operating in Alaska. I can definitely think of a couple that may end up having this type of incorporation and this type of profit, but I was just curious if we knew that there were any currently besides the one we've talked about.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Carrick. I think Representative Sadler had a question.
I did think. First off, I guess I'm not sure if I should direct it to Evan or to the chair, but to whoever wants to speak on behalf of the bill. Why $25 million? That seems to be, won't say arbitrary, but just why $25 million as opposed to $30 million or $10 million or $1 million?
I can speak to that. So the C Corp threshold is five, and this is trying to strike a balance of having equity for very large corporations without necessarily ensnaring a small legal practice or a smallish medical practice or some of the other, what I think people would consider smaller businesses that may be incorporated as an LLC or a sole proprietorship or an S-Corp. So when we think about the threshold, I think if we want to close the S-Corp loophole, we just have to think about that balance of what the threshold is. And I thought the point at which a company is earning $25 million in taxable income, my hope would be that they would be large enough and healthy enough that this would not impede their ability to thrive in the state of Alaska, because we want more companies to be large and successful in our state. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
A 9.4% tax is not the way to get a company to thrive in Alaska's economy. But if you say the C-Corp threshold is $5 million, and you said something about you wanted to provide equity for large corporations, explain what you mean by that and how this setting this at $25 million achieves equity for large corporations.
Very large corporations earning $25, $50, $500 million in taxable income, I think it does make sense to have equity in taxation because those are all large corporations. And my concept with this bill is simply have equity across large corporations in terms of the income tax that they pay.
And if I may probe it, when you say have equity, what do you mean by that specifically?
Pay the same tax rate.
Okay, very good. Okay.
I don't think it makes sense to have two corporations. They each earn $500 million in what would otherwise be taxable income. One pays taxes, one doesn't, based on a corporation tax, incorporation type. Yeah. I just think as a fundamental matter of economics and tax policy, that makes no sense.
Okay. And if I may.
Sure.
So my understanding of the C-Corp income tax, business tax, is that it's graduated up to 9.4%. It's not, boom, 9.4.
Yep.
So why not have the graduated tax rate for the S-Corps as well?
That honestly would be a great amendment, and I would happily entertain it because I think what I introduced this bill to be a vehicle to try to have a discussion about equity and tax policy, and if you all have input on the threshold and the rate at which it's graduated, I think that's a great thing to bring to the table.
Did you want to follow up, Dan?
No, different topic. Different.
Go ahead, Rep. Klum.
Line.
Okay, so Rep. Sadler got the graduated part that I was going to ask about. So there's a part in the bill that says they can't use tax credits. Can you expound on that, or you can't use credit against it, or how's that interacting with any kind of credits that are established already?
Right, and my intent under this bill was actually to have equity in the use of tax credits, child care, education, et cetera, and I'll turn to Evan Anderson to elaborate on that.
For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. It's a great question through the chair to Rep. Klum. All of the existing tax credits under Alaska statute still can be applied is the intent of how we drafted this bill. So that includes, education tax credit. I have a short list here. Minerals, exploration incentive, the qualified in-state oil refinery infrastructure expenditure. Those are all still applicable. I think when you might see something in the bill about tax credits that applies to the federal taxation.
Oh, okay. So follow up. So our tax credits apply? Okay.
Yeah, and if it was an oil and gas company, I mean, we want to incentivize production, and under this they would be able to.
Yeah, I guess that generally taxes don't incentivize business in general.
Sure.
So, and that's my issue. I mean, we're saying that a business making $25 million of taxable income is not the same as someone making $500 million. I think it could easily be a medical center and get 25. So I'm really concerned about how low it is, but I guess I'd have to explore it more. And also, I'm concerned about the business partnership. Like, is this showing that we're a good partner with business? I understand the equitable motivation for that, but there might be some unintended consequences here with smaller businesses. $25 million is not a huge corporation anymore.
Yep. And I appreciate that and certainly welcome ideas to refine it. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the main thing I hear from entrepreneurs and investors right now is around concern about large class size in the schools, mm-hmm. inadequately funded schools. So I think this is balance. We want to have decently funded public services, so highly skilled people want to move here and raise a family. Mm-hmm. So how do we fund those core services at a minimal tax burden on Alaskans?
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough question to answer.
Yeah, I think for me, when you tell a business you got to give this to the state, it really reduces their investment opportunities. They will take that from things that they might have invested in. Now they have to pay taxes to the state, so it kind of stagnates businesses. They may still grow, but it'll slow down because they won't invest as much.
And I don't think it's a bad idea to look at a graduated rate that goes up to a higher threshold if that's something that you would like to consider. I would be strongly inclined to support that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you to the sponsor, I guess, the chair. Any idea of the number of businesses this would apply to?
I don't have that because DOR tells us that they don't know who is not currently subject to a tax because they are not filing for said taxes. So it's an interesting conundrum.
Interesting. So reconnaissance by fire. Put a tax out there and see who pays?
I actually did do some research. Alaska Business Monthly publishes a list of companies and revenue and number of employees, and you can look at what are the 49 largest companies in the state, and what is their gross revenue? Gross revenue is not necessarily taxable income, of course, but you can eyeball that, and then you can start to review it and look at corporation type. Hmm. And honestly, like, this is, to me, more forward-looking. I don't know who is going to locate here and thrive in the future, and I think we should strive for greater equity and treatment of corporations, regardless of how they're incorporated. And I hope that we have a variety of thriving corporations, S Corp, C Corps, and otherwise. So it is designed to be a forward looking bill.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Just in their general discussion, the term equity is respectfully a little bit of a loaded term. It's like fair share, equal. I heard equal like that. That's a mathematical. Just a raw fact and not any kind of judgment on whether it's fair or equitable. Those are different terms. But has there been any modeling of the impact of what this tax might be?
To answer your first question, I mean equity simply as a percentage of income. So without judgment about fairness, but simple, equal. I am not aware of this bill being introduced before, and therefore I'm not aware of sort of longer-term modeling. Go ahead, Evan Anderson, if you have more to add on that.
Yeah, for the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. I don't know if we have Mr. Brandon Spanos online yet, but I think we'd be happy to get a hold of the Department of Revenue for a future hearing and invite them in to share their numbers. I will say there is a fiscal note for the bill, and they're anticipating up to $110 million in annual revenue as a result of this measure.
Okay. The reason I ask that. Sure.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
The reason I ask is when the governor rolled out his revenue things at Centennial and other forums, he mentioned work that had been done by the Institute for Social Economic Research that had modeled the impact
right.
of what taxes would work well. So I didn't know if there was any coattail work on that or if ICER was chewing away as we speak about the modeling the effects of this kind of tax.
Yeah, I have not seen ICER modeling on it. I did review that, and getting back to Rep. Colum's question, I think when you look at sort of our long-term fiscal prospects, we don't actually have to raise a ton of money to have a sustainable budget. We have to raise a little bit, and I'm curious to see what can sustain core services at the lowest cost to people who live and work in Alaska.
And schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I say something?
Absolutely.
So I wanted to address this whole Hillcourt, this equity thing. I think, so in Alaska, we have a bit of a unique situation. We have a corporation that came up here to invest in Alaska, and we said, S corps aren't taxed. They made those decisions under that. That's where I get the hiccup is for me, because they made decisions based on that. We all know Alaska is way more expensive to develop and has a lot of challenges than Texas or anywhere else. So my problem is, and maybe it's the graduation of the tax would probably help that, mm-hmm. but we've had somebody who is like essential to cooking the gas,
right?
And I don't. You know, you can look at Washington and all these states, but they're really not comparable to this the specific situation we're dealing with one corporation that made a decision to put billions of dollars into Alaska, and then we just flipped the switch. And so I don't know how you fix that. I do think that we should have more equitable tax structure. I don't think this is the only issue with our tax structure, but it's really hard for me to I don't like the term loophole. I always feel like the corporation that we talk about is always made to look like they're getting away with something. But really, I mean, we weren't here when that happened, but there was an agreement. And so I don't know, any thoughts on how we could, you know, possibly make it more equitable, but not have the corporation be sorry they've invested in Alaska.
Yeah, well, like, I totally agree with you. Hillcorp has invested hundreds of billions of dollars in development. They've done a great job getting gas out of Cook Inlet. I support that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably reasonable to assume when they moved here, they did look at, well, what are the odds that the Alaska legislature modernizes their tax code? I mean, honestly, our tax code is way outdated.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't reflect the growth of S-Corps in U.S. society. And I think that's my underlying issue. So I'm very interested in looking at how do we modernize our tax code
mm-hmm.
and remain competitive, recognizing challenging economics in Cook Inlet, maybe good economics up on the slope. That's mm-hmm. a mixed environment. But yeah, like I said, I introduced the bill because I don't like people criticizing Hillcorp. I support Hillcorp. I think they do great work. I think we should be pursuing royalty modification on their leases in Cook Inlet. That would incentivize production. That would be another tax change I would support. And I think we have to modernize our tax code around S corps and C corps.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rep. Saylor.
I would note that Hillcorp has the largest. I mean, you can probably assume that revenue-wise, they're doing the most under the S-Corp. So Hillcorp would be the biggest payer of taxes under this bill.
They would right now, Representative Saylor, but I want to look ahead. You know, I don't think when the legislature eliminated the income tax, they foresaw Hillcorp, and mm-hmm. we're going to have other S-Corps come in here, and I hope be really successful. And I just want to look ahead and think about how we fund core services and have greater parity in terms of the percentage taxes paid for very large corporations.
Could I just offer something to be a contrarian?
Absolutely.
I would say I'm not sure that the problem is funding core services. It's managing our core services. They're not being managed well, and it's very expensive. Just throwing that out there.
Okay. Well, I appreciate everyone taking the time to think about this new bill. And I don't think we have any other further business before the committee. So at 4:20, unless anyone else wants to bring something up, so at 4:24, we're adjourned.